Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Red Room. It's with me, your host, Jenny. I know an episode that's not out on Monday. This is going to be an unlocked episode from my Patreon. So I have a Patreon where every week we go down a different rabbit hole. If you've only been listening to my True Crime Stories season, this could be of interest to you. If it's something you enjoy, we do a much broader scope of topics over there, everything from conspiracies, unsolved mysteries. We do true crime as well. And this episode was from back in November, and I thought I'd release it as a bonus episode because it has come back up in the news. So this is when I did a deep dive on P. Diddy, Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, because of the lawsuit filed by his ex-girlfriend back in November 2023 that has seemingly opened up Pandora's box, so to speak, on Puff Daddy's illicit and scandalous background, the goings on behind the scenes of his massive, massive, multi-billion dollar music empire, really. And I thought it would be a good episode to release for everyone, maybe for the bank holiday weekend, if you are celebrating Easter this weekend. So this episode is not so much only dedicated to breaking down some of the lawsuit files that have been filed, and there is a small update on it that I do want to give before we get going, but it's mostly a background of P. Diddy. Okay, we're building the case in this episode to see how believable, spoiler alert, I think incredibly, unbelievably, undeniably believable these accusations are, because when you just even peer behind the curtain of Puff Daddy's career just a little bit, you are smacked in the face with controversy, violence, accusations, rumors, terrible, terrible, horrible behavior. And I think it's very interesting to look at. So in this episode, just to give you a quick synopsis of what we're going to cover, we're going to cover the alleged mob ties that have been following Diddy for years, which also go back to his father. We're going to talk about rap industry scandals that he has been involved in, which are extremely violent. Everything from some stuff with J-Lo, his ex-girlfriend, ex-fiance, I believe, Mace controversy, and the conspiracy around Tupac's death. We're then going to move on to how he was involved in both Usher and Justin Bieber's early career, had them living in his house when they were just teenagers, moving on to how he started Danity Kane, their accusations against him, which include trafficking, his romantic relationships and abuse allegations over the years, including the fact that the mother to his children went missing and died after she was threatening to release a book about Sean Combs. Then we finally go into detail on the Cassie lawsuit. I'll give you a content warning for this entire episode, really, but especially for the Cassie lawsuit, because we speak very verbatim in that, quoting directly from the source. But the content warning about this whole episode would be about domestic abuse, sexual abuse, grooming, drugging, anything around that. I don't go into detail when I don't have to go into detail, but when we are speaking about a case that is going through the courts, I find it best to use very straightforward language that is directly pulled from firsthand sources. So just so you know, all of that kind of stuff is going to be in this episode. But I do want to talk about the updates and why this is back in the news. So on Monday this week, March 25th, Sean Combs' homes in both Los Angeles and Miami were searched by Homeland Security investigations. And this is huge for a house to be raided like this. The searches were connected to sex trafficking investigations by federal authorities and some rumored other investigations, which they have not confirmed yet. And the authorities that have been undergoing the investigation are located in New York City. The raid came off the back as well as this new lawsuit that had been added to the multiple other lawsuits that we talk about in this episode. And it was filed by producer Rodney Lilrod Jones. This lawsuit was filed in February this year, so about 4 months after Cassie and the other women's lawsuits were filed. And he alleges Sean Combs, or P. Diddy, of abusing him over a year-long period when he was living on Puffy's properties while working on his music. So the lawsuit filed on February 26th asked for $30 million in damages after accusing him of sex trafficking, abuse, forced drug use, fraud, and sexual assault. Now, what's craziest, and what I presume is the reason that this has majorly put a fire under the feds' asses to investigate Diddy and raid his home for any evidence, is because within this 73-page lawsuit are photos, screenshots, and stills from videos that apparently prove all of his accusations against Diddy. This is so rare because typically when someone is in the midst of these abusive situations, they're not exactly, you know, keeping screenshots. They're usually very, very afraid of the person who is abusing them, specifically if it's a romantic relationship where they would have access to phones, and all of that will come up in this episode. But Lil Rod apparently kept his receipts. The evidence in the documents included are pictures of blood, apparently from a shooting that he accuses Sean Combs and his son of covering up, screenshots of two men appearing in a sexual act, which Lil Rod says Diddy forced him to watch, telling him that one of the men who is named in the lawsuit was an esteemed musician that he admired. The lawsuit claims that Diddy uses Lil Rod's admiration for the musician to groom and entice him into engaging in homosexuality or sexual activity. And apparently Diddy told him amongst this grooming that homosexuality is a normal practice in the music industry. Just want to add a quick caveat here. Again, these are the words directly from the lawsuit, not my opinion. I'm not inferring that homosexuality is wrong or that bisexuality is wrong, but it's more presenting it as a way that P. Diddy was using this to groom and manipulate and control people. Next was a series of stills of a video from a party that happened on Thanksgiving 2022 that showed Lil Rod and Diddy at the party, but also another rapper called Young Miami and her cousin. It's alleged in the lawsuit that Diddy told Young Miami's cousin to follow Lil Rod to the bathroom and offer him sexual services. And when apparently they were rejected, she followed him back to the party and tried to have sex with him in front of all the other attendees. He also accuses Diddy of forcing him to take cocaine at the party. There is a series of video stills that show Diddy talking to Oscar-winning actor Cuba Gooding Jr. on board the rapper's yacht. Now, Lil Rod says he believes Diddy had been grooming him to pass off to his friends, including Gooding Jr. There are pictures of Lil Rod with Gooding Jr., which apparently show him touching, groping, and fondling his legs. Some of the photos also show a strip club called the Booby Trap, where Lil Rod said Diddy sent him to find sex workers, even though Lil Rod did not want to do so. Mr. Combs provided Mr. Jones with an exclusive Bad Boy base cap and required him to wear it to the strip club on the river as a signal to any sex worker he approached that Mr. Combs was in town and he had sent Mr. Jones to recruit them. Another explosive claim in the lawsuit alleges Diddy drugged Lil Rod and the latter woke up in his bed finding himself with two workers and Diddy. There are photos in the suit allegedly showing the sex workers and Diddy sleeping in the bed. One allegation was that Diddy regularly partied with sex workers and underage girls. The suit showed multiple video stills with Diddy dancing with women whose faces are blacked out for anonymity, but claims that they are in fact underage. The lawsuit also compared Christina Coram, who is Diddy's chief of staff, to Ghislaine Maxwell, obviously, who is serving 20 years in prison for sex trafficking women and girls to her ex-boyfriend, Jeffrey Epstein. The lawsuit even included a photo of Coram sitting beside Diddy on a lounge in a similar photo to one of Epstein and Maxwell. So there are so many explosive things coming out about this case. If it goes any further, if there are massive, massive updates, which I'm presuming there might be, I can do another episode maybe over on Patreon for you all, another bonus episode to update you on them. But for now, I hope you enjoy this episode, or enjoy it as best you can. It's pretty dark territory. I hope it makes it clear for you some of the background of Diddy. It's a lot of stuff that I did not know about him. And truly, it blew my mind really deep diving into this. There will be another episode out on Monday, as usual, for everyone to enjoy. That will be a classic old true crime episode. But if you want more content like what you're going to hear, you can go over to my Patreon. It's always linked in the show description. You can sign up and you'll get weekly episodes, just in case you want a little bit more Red Room. Okay, enjoy the episode. Sean Combs, also known as Puff, Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, and most recently Love, has been one of the most prominent figures in hip hop for the last 30 years. Working closely with artists like Mary J. Blige, the Notorious B.I.G., Mace, Faith Evans, amongst many, many other stars in the late 90s and early 2000s, his record label Bad Boy Records was packed full of superstars. But rumours and gossip have always followed the music mogul. Not only was Puff a central figure in the West and East Coast hip-hop rivalry of the mid-90s that ended with two of its biggest stars, Tupac and Notorious B.I.G., dying long before they reached their artistic potential, his shady business dealings and alleged mob ties have also been long rumoured too. There have always been rumours about his personal life, from rumours of bisexuality to grooming to straight-up accusations of abuse. But the recent lawsuit filed by his longtime ex-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura, opened up a Pandora's box of accusations that he can no longer run from. It has even reopened questions surrounding the mysterious death of his longtime ex-partner and mother to his children, Kim Porter, who died in suspicious circumstances after she threatened to release a tell-all novel about Diddy and their relationship. This week, we're deep diving on Diddy and looking at all of his shady connections of the last 30 years. So first I want to go through the background of Sean Combs and his early life, right? Because not so much to show like all of his successes and to paint a good picture before tearing him down, but more so to kind of show how much power he yielded, how much wealth. And I think it just does paint a picture of, like, I don't know, something sketchy just always being around him. So let's get into it, right? Sean John Combs was born in Harlem, New York City on November 4th, 1969. Although he was born in the city, he was raised in Mount Vernon in New York, which is north of the Bronx. And he was raised by his mother, Janice Combs. His father, a man called Melvin Earl Combs, was a former US Air Force employee who later began working in organized crime and drugs. And he was an associate of the convicted New York drug dealer, drug baron, really, Frank Lucas, who ran a lot of heroin into New York in the 70s. So this involvement in crime led to his father's early death. He was just 33 years old when he was shot dead in his car on Central Park West. Bit of creepy foreshadowing there. And at the time, Sean John was only 2 years old. So Sean went to school in the Bronx, which was nearby where he grew up. He played football and he was a pretty good football player. This is where he got his nickname Puff, because apparently he had a short fuse and he was known to huff and puff when things did not go his way. Very interestingly, one of Puff's best friends in high school, as well as his former football teammate, was a man called, or a guy, I guess a young man at the time, called Andrew Campos. Now, Andrew would go on to be very rich in his own right after he got involved in the Gambino crime family. And yes, that is the same one led by the infamous mobster John Gotti. Campos was part of the largest consumer fraud scheme in American history, one that cost unwary customers around $750 million. And it was from related schemes involving phone sex and internet porn. Now, we'll touch back on this in a moment, but this is just to let you guys know that these two remain very close for a very long time. I believe they're still friends, and their relationship is rumoured to be the beginning of Puff's mob and crime ties. Puff would go on to enrol in Howard University, where he majored in business studies, but he would not get his degree. He dropped out after 2 years of studying. However, it was here that his entrepreneurial spirit was evident. He held weekly hip-hop dance parties that were always full, and he ran a shuttle bus service for fellow students traveling back and forth from the airport to visit home. As we said, though, college was not for him. He had other plans, and those plans were to infiltrate the music industry. And that was his next step. In 1990, he started an internship at New York's Uptown Records. He worked under a man called Andre Harrell, who founded Uptown Records and helped shape the sound of hip-hop and R&B in the late 80s and 90s. Now, while working under Harrell, as first a talent intern, then a talent manager, and later becoming talent director, he helped develop artists like Mary J. Blige reach stardom. Harrell was a mentor to Puff. He housed him in his house, which Puff called a mansion. He guided him very closely in the early days of career. And within just 1 year of his internship, he rose the ranks all the way to vice president of Uptown Records. But his career almost capsized when a riot occurred at a 1991 basketball event that he promoted in New York City, and 9 people ended up being killed in a stampede at this event. Puff apparently was on the ground trying to revive dead bodies, and he suffered a large amount of trauma following this event, which led him to suffer from depression and a small breakdown. But he got back in the business, and his ambitions came back too, stronger than ever. He went from being a shy kind of background character who was happy to let all the talent do all the talking to a cocky and arrogant talent director who would do anything to get what he wanted. One of the many people who thought that he had got a little bit too cocky was his mentor, Andre Harrell, who eventually fired him in 1993. As Uptown began to get bigger and bigger with more financial investment, Harrell obviously had more people to make happy other than Puff. And Puff did not like this because he felt he was being ignored and also limited creatively. He would go on to say it became a situation where it was two kings in one castle and it was his castle, so I found myself the moat. Based on his success at Uptown, in 1993, Sean Combs signed a $15 million distribution deal with Arista Records for his Bad Boy Entertainment label. Bad Boy Records was officially launched in 1994, the signing of only 2 artists, Craig Mack and friend and collaborator Notorious B.I.G. Bad Boy Records went on to achieve success with Notorious B.I.G. and Craig Mack, as well as Mace, Lil' Kim, D-Block, The LOX, Carl Thomas, Faith Evans, 112 and Total. Huge, huge acts from this iconic era of hip-hop came from Bad Boy Records. In 1996, Puff parlayed Bad Boy's success into an unprecedented 50-50 joint venture with Clive Davis and Arista Records, enabling the label to effectively market its roster of artists to a global marketplace. Throughout the 90s, Puff and Bad Boy Records had made huge successes. He produced several songs for TLC's Crazy Sexy Cool, which was one of the most influential and biggest hip-hop albums of the year, especially for female hip-hop. And in 1997, under the name Puff Daddy, Combs recorded his first commercial vocal work as a rapper. After his good friend Notorious B.I.G. was murdered, he released the song I'll Be Missing You, which was on his album Can't Hold Me Down and featured Faith Evans, which was a massive commercial success and gave him footing into being an artist in his own right as well as a producer. The album earned him 5 nominations at the Grammy Awards in 1998, and he'd go on to win Grammy Award for Best Rap Album of the same year. But by the late 90s, he had his fair share of critics too. He was being criticized for watering down and commercializing hip hop and for using too many guest appearances and samples in his new songs. Bad Boy Records would end its distribution deal with Arista Records in 2002. And as part of the deal, Puff Daddy gained full control of Bad Boy Records, including the complete artist roster and entire catalog. In 2003, he signed a distribution deal with Universal. And around this time, Bad Boy was losing a lot of talent. They were signing people but losing them because a lot of the artists just weren't happy with their publishing deals. Many signed contracts that allowed Puff to receive royalties from any music made by them for the rest of their life, whether or not Bad Boy or he had any involvement in it. And despite this, Puff would always publicly say that he's for the artist, which would infuriate people. But it didn't really matter to Puff. He was signing bigger and bigger artists every single day, making more and more money, and Bad Boy was becoming one of the most lucrative record labels in the business. He would go on to have multiple businesses as well. He did not just stick to music. He went into fashion with Sean John Clothing. Puff was awarded the Men's Designer of the Year Award by the Council of Fashion Designers of America in 2004. He ventured into beauty with Estee Lauder. Sean John's signature fragrance, Unforgivable, was number one in US department stores. His men and women's fragrances would go on to win multiple awards as well. In 2007, he partnered with Diageo for a groundbreaking strategic alliance overseeing and managing all brands and marketing initiatives for Ciroc Vodka. He infamously hosted the White Party for years also, which I believe he even had one, if not this year, definitely last year. He had so many other successful businesses and is a highly connected person, both in the business and in the music world. And I don't tell of these successes, obviously, just to herald him as some like business magnate and amazing entrepreneur. But as I said at the start of the episode, just it's to show how powerful he was. Like, for example, I was not a hip hop fan when I was younger, right? But everyone knew who Puff Daddy was. He was such a household name. I wouldn't have known when I was younger again. Wasn't really until Eminem came on the scene that I became more aware of other people within the hip hop community. But I knew who Puff Daddy was. It was, I guess, the name. He was always so flashy. He was, you know, dating people like Jennifer Lopez. For me, he was just a household name. And if he got down to me, he was worldwide massive. In 2011, Forbes cited his net worth to be $475 million. And it's rumored that he's pretty much close to a billion by now. This is an extremely well-connected and powerful man. Throughout his career, he would have multiple highly publicized romantic relationships with other celebrities like Kimberly Porter, Jennifer Lopez, and of course, more recently, Cassie Ventura. He's also had multiple legal lawsuits and issues, allegations and rumors following him over the last 30 years, the biggest of which we are going to cover today, of course, in detail, which is the shocking and incredibly horrific lawsuit and record-breaking settlement, I'd say, with his former longtime partner, Cassie Ventura. Puff in recent years, and possibly in a very kind of contrived post-Me Too era, PR kind of spin, has attempted to rebrand himself as Brother Love and put himself on the forefront as the face, really, as of the Black Excellence movement. He has even changed his middle name to Love in 2020. But this kind of rebrand just cannot hide his prolonged history of violence dating all the way back to the 90s. Although he's never been convicted of a serious crime, he has repeatedly been accused of having violent encounters with everyone from his exes like Cassie Ventura and Gina Quinn to executive Steve Stout and rappers like J. Cole, Drake, and even 50 Cent has chimed in. He's a huge critic of his, especially recently. So let's cover the allegations, the crime ties, and everything else, all of the skeletons in the closet. Sean Combs, a.k.a. Puff Daddy. Remember Puff's friend, Andrew Campos? Well, we're going to look at him first, and we're going to look at how the pair remained friends truly through thick and thin. So Puff, as we said, has been embroiled in multiple violent run-ins and controversies throughout his career, and so has his friend Andrew Campos, although a little bit lower on the radar. He has been indicted for racketeering, amongst many other crazy accusations. And their long-standing friendship has been documented by law enforcement sources and official court records. And most of what we're talking about today has been obtained by a website called Gangland News, which is a pretty good source for any mob news. So over the years, there's been multiple sightings of Campos and other wise guys, so to speak, attending recording sessions as guests of Puff. And there's been a lot of rumors that they use these kind of, because a recording session is, people aren't going to be opening the doors. It's a very private matter. You know, it's a soundproof room. And this is could be a good place, basically, people think, for some meetings to take place. People also think that maybe they're coming in to meet Puff himself. There's a lot of allegations that they are, you know, putting up some money, but we'll get to that. In 2004, on the same day that Campos was indicted in a telephone scamming scheme that grossed up to $600,000 a day, the one we mentioned earlier, Gambino capo Gregory De Palma informed his associate in Florida about an indictment and linked it to a group trip that Campos made to Combs in Florida. The conversation was picked up during a 2-year FBI undercover investigation, and it led to racketeering and other charges against De Palma and 34 others. De Palma was caught on the phone saying, "You know that guy you had there with P. Diddy? He got pinched, you know." And he then read the names of various Gambino family members and associates, including no one other than Andrew Campos. On a previous trip to meet Puff Daddy in Florida, Campos was accompanied by soldier Louis Felipe, who along with De Palma was indicted on racketeering charges in March 2005. In 2003, Louis Felipe, the same guy, opened an East Harlem restaurant, and Campos called up his old friend Puff to, you know, to ask him to come down, do some publicity, which apparently Puff did. During the same period from July to October 2003, Felipe, De Palma and a few others were shaking down local radio stations for free ads for the restaurant, which ended up closing its doors about a year later. And this kind of is just building the case of, like, what exactly is the money behind Diddy, right? Because we are going to get into it later. He did have some investment from another shady ass guy, a very shady guy, Clive Davis. But this is not something new. The mob will use people who want something, people who want money, power, status, and they will get them that and give them that. But, you know, in turn, they are used as a pawn. Okay. Like, for example, you'll see it with Frank Sinatra. You know, this is not an unusual thing to happen. And as we're going to get into later, the music industry is an industry that is ripe for taking advantage of people, for smuggling drugs, for smuggling people, for trafficking people, trafficking drugs, all sorts of things. So it just is one of the many suspicious links that he has. But now let's get into the rap industry scandals, because this is where stuff gets violent very quickly.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So Puff has been at the center of all these controversies right in the music industry over the last 30 years, from publishing rights scandals, incidents of assault on other artists, and to conspiracy theories about his involvement with the murder of Tupac and his friend Biggie Smalls. So the first incidents that really kicked off a lot and that he was very central to was the shooting of a man called Jake Robles in 1995. So Puff Daddy, his biggest enemy was the man called Suge Knight. Now, they were once friends, but because Suge Knight owned Death Row Records, which was rival record label to P. Diddy, amongst, I'm sure there's many other reasons, I'm really simplifying it, they basically ended up having just this huge rivalry. And really what kicked it all off, one of the first deaths linked to this rivalry, was the death of Jake Robles, who was Suge Knight's friend and security guard. And he was killed outside of a nightclub after an argument with a group of people from the bad boy camp, so to speak. So everyone was there celebrating musician Jermaine Dupri's birthday at Platinum City Club when an argument broke out between members of Bad Boy and Death Row Records. Now, Sheriff Deputy Chris Howard said that he escorted Sean Combs and his guests outside to leave the club and thought the coast was clear. And this was like, you know, he thought it was clear enough to let Suge Knight and his entourage leave. But when it happened, basically Suge Knight's partner was just about to get into his limo when all of a sudden Puffy's guys comes up around the corner. One of them pulls a gun. Howard chases this guy, but he gives the gun to another person who then shoots a few rounds and ends up shooting and killing Robles right there. And then the person then jumped into a car and it carried Combs and his associates. Robles did die a few weeks later at Atlanta Hospital, and Puff Daddy has involved any involvement in the shooting, but Suge Knight has always held him responsible. In 1998, Sean Combs and two other men attacked music executive Stephen Stout, who was then the manager of rapper Nas. Now, Nas and Puff Daddy had done a music video together for their song Hate Me Now, which contained scenes of Puff Daddy dressed as Jesus Christ being crucified. But Puff didn't like this and he wasn't happy that the scene ended up airing on TV. So they decided to turn up to Steve Stout's studio and show him a lesson. So according to Stout, Puff and two men barged into his office and attacked him with a champagne bottle. He was charged with second degree assault and criminal mischief. Stout claims that his arm and his jaw were broken in the attack, but Puff denied that any bones are broken. He basically went on to MTV and said, "I went into his office and what happened there I can't really speak about, but what I can say is this. The way I handled myself in his office was completely wrong and I've since apologized to Steve about that and I felt disappointed in myself." Combs was sentenced to a one-day anger management class. So one of his most famous ex-girlfriends was Jennifer Lopez. But something that's not very much known about them is this incident that happened to them in 1999. So J-Lo and he were at a club called Hot Chocolate in Midtown, New York City, and they were celebrating the release of a rapper called Shine's soon-to-be-released album. Now, Shine was a rapper who was Puff's protege. He was signed to Bad Boy Entertainment, and this album was meant to come out, and it was meant to be huge. At around 2:20 a.m., Lopez was leaving the club with Puff, apparently champagne bottle in hand, when Puff Daddy knocked into a guy and drowned him in champagne, apparently. The guy's name was Matthew Allen, but he was better known by his street name, Scar. And this was just basically the wrong guy to piss off. And a huge argument broke out where I think this guy Scar started to throw shade at Puff, saying like something about his wealth. And then Puff like threw money like confetti in his face. It all escalated. Shots were fired. Three of the club's patrons were injured and one woman was shot in the face in the crossfire. So J-Lo and Puff did manage to escape. They got into her car and they ran a red light and were pulled over by police. They were found in possession of a stolen 9mm handgun, but it was found in the trunk of the car, which was J-Lo's. And because it was her car, she would spend the next 14 hours in a police cell, where apparently she spent the entire night sobbing uncontrollably. And I will say, I found this article from around the time, and it was just so... It's mad when you see these old articles from the late 90s, early 2000s, because the policeman said this. He was like, yes, she was sobbing uncontrollably. And then they asked him, was she as good looking in real life? And he was like, she's kind of a plain Jane vibe. Like, it's just like, oh yeah, that's what's important in this situation. Jesus Christ. Anyway, the charges were eventually dropped for J-Lo, and then later they were dropped for Puff himself. But the rumor was that this was just the end of their relationship, because Puff basically allowed J-Lo to take the blame for the gun. He allowed her to be arrested. You know, he could have been like, that's my gun. Like, she didn't know it was in there, whatever else. And then she was detained. And obviously this became public record, which was not like, which could have been a huge risk for her career. J-Lo and Puff Daddy did eventually split on Valentine's Day 2001, which I believe was pretty soon after the charges were dropped. But something that's really, really sad is that Shine, the rapper, okay, remember he was his party that they were at. He was really fucked over by P. Diddy in this situation. He was accused of being connected to the shooting, even though like he wasn't. Like, it was just his party, and he would spend 9 years in jail over this. And apparently, according to him and according to his lawyers, what really put him behind bars was that Diddy decided to like agree with the prosecution. And he was like the person who's also being accused, his co-accusee. came out saying that Shine was bad. Shine was linked up with all these dodgy characters. That's what happened with the shootout, blah, blah, blah. Shine goes to prison for 9 years. His album never comes out and his career just completely dies. This is meant to be P. Diddy's protege and he completely fucked him over. One musician that has not been afraid to call Diddy out though is Mace. So you might have remember I mentioned him earlier on. He was one of the early musicians linked and signed under Bad Boy Records. So first we have to talk about how P. Diddy was honoured at a pre-Grammys gala in 2020 and he made a speech addressing the Recording Academy's lack of acknowledgement for hip-hop and R&B music. Let's take a listen to what he said in that speech.
Name is an added on name if you want to call me Love. And it's not just about the Grammys. There's discrimination and injustice everywhere at an all-time high. But there's something I need to say to the Grammys. And I changed my name to, my middle name to Love. So it's Sean Love Combs now. You don't have to call me a different name. It's an added on name if you want to call me Love. So I say this with love to the Grammys. Cause you really need to know this. Every year, y'all be killing us, man. Man, I'm talking about the pain. I'm speaking for all the artists here, the producers, the executives, the amount of time that it takes to make these records, to pour your heart out into it, and you just want an even playing field. In the great words of Erykah Badu, we are artists and we are sensitive about our We are passionate. For most of us, this is all we got. This is our only hope. Truth be told, hip hop has never been respected by the Grammys. Black music has never been respected by the Grammys to the point that it should be. So right now, this current situation, it's not a revelation. This thing been going on. And it's not just going on in music, it's going on in film, it's going on in sports, it's going on around the world. And for years, we've allowed institutions that have never had our best interests at heart to judge us. And that stops right now.
So his speech addresses how the Academy has failed to fully recognize R&B and hip hop as, a legitimate music genre, which is true. But he lauded himself as this hero to the music industry, says that he puts his artists first, all these kind of things, and this pissed off Mace. Mace claims to have been completely taken advantage of by Diddy, and he claims that he offered to pay Diddy $2 million in cash only recently to buy back his own publishing rights. He says that Puff originally bought the publishing rights for only 20 grand, and that the rights weren't even close to being worth 2 million, but that Diddy flat out refused to sell them. He went on Instagram to explain further, saying that Puff has a horrendous business model. He said, quote, "I hear your Grammy speech about how you are now for the artist and about how the artist must take back control. So I'll be the first to take that initiative. Also, before we ask other ethnicities to do us right, we should do us as black people better, especially the creators. I heard you loud and clear and when you said that you are now for the artist. And to that, my response is if you want to see change, you can make change today by starting with yourself." And finally, the conspiracy around Tupac and Biggie's death. This is crazy. And this is something that has followed him for years, but it's been really, even before the Cassie stuff came up, there's been stories popping up about Puff Daddy in connection to the death of Tupac and even one of his best friends, Biggie Smalls. So if you've no idea about the beef, I'll try and give a little rundown. Again, it's something that it's very dense beef. Dare I say it's complicated. I don't fully understand it. It's been one of those stories, that just for years you can't get to what is the root of this? How did this happen? But again, I guess it's one of those things that it has, personal relationships involved, money, music, gangland stuff that, I'm just not going to be the person to understand it. But from my understanding, Tupac and Biggie Smalls, just like Sean Combs and Suge Knight, started off as friends. They were both from New York City, but then obviously Tupac moved to the West Coast. And they're coming up around the same time, but Tupac's career kind of shot off way before Biggie's did, which I think started some tension between the two. Now, Tupac was signed to Def Jam with Suge Knight, and then Biggie obviously was signed with Bad Boy Records. But the seeds of the Tupac and Biggie beef can be traced back to an infamous incident in 1994 when Tupac was robbed and shot multiple times in a New York City recording studio. So Tupac believed that members of Biggie's Bad Boy Records were involved. So he felt really betrayed by his own friend. These are people that he thought had his back, and he thinks like they basically set him up for a shootout and he was nearly killed. He then went to jail. And the whole conflict just escalated from like this kind of small tension to just an all out feud. If you're looking for something that goes into more detail, that docuseries, the kind of biopic docuseries on Biggie Smalls is really, really good. It's on Netflix. It's brilliant. I really enjoyed it. Clearly, still don't understand the beef fully though. I don't know why. But anyway, the feud played out publicly in their music and in interviews, with both of them taking hits at each other in diss tracks. Tupac released songs like Hit 'Em Up and Against All Odds that accused Biggie and all of Bad Boy of being responsible for the attack, and he labeled them as traitors. Biggie then responded with tracks like Who Shot Ya and Long Kiss Goodnight, and it just added fuel to the fire. Now, there's rumors that these songs by Biggie, like the release wasn't really Biggie's decision, and Puff Daddy kind of encouraged him to do so because he wanted to capitalize off the feud, but he also had his own rivalry going with Suge Knight. Obviously, in between this and then, the shooting of that bodyguard happened, and, you know, Puff Daddy was being accused by Suge Knight of kind of being responsible for that. And he wanted to see the end of Death Row, which would have been the end of Tupac, because he knew that that Tupac was probably their biggest earner at the time. So Tupac did a final interview with a journalist called Angie Martinez, and it was never released because basically, I think Tupac was like mask off during it. Like, he was accusing Puff Daddy of crazy things. He ended up incriminating himself on loads of stuff as well. He was just out of prison. So they were kind of like, this is a little bit too hot to touch. It's also going to escalate a feud that has already gone violent. So they didn't really want anything to do with it. But some say Puff was who got it stopped, and he heard about it and he heard what Tupac had said about him and made sure it didn't get out. Now, I wonder how he did that. For me, I'm thinking like mob ties, all this kind of stuff, gang ties. Angie Martinez herself said that she heard that Biggie and Puff did read it and didn't like it. But overall, the tension just kept escalating until September 7th, when Tupac was shot in Las Vegas in 1996. And this is a crime that has yet to be completely solved. There's been arrests, I think, just recently over it, and we'll get to them later. And months later, on March 9th, 1997, Biggie Smalls was killed in a drive-by shooting in Los Angeles. Then this year, a man called Dwayne Keith Davis, better known as Keith D, was charged with a murder charge linked to the death of Tupac Shakur. Now, he's believed to be the only surviving member of the four Crips, or like gang members, who killed Shakur in this drive-by shooting in 1996. And he claims that he knew Sean Combs, aka Puff Daddy, for years and years, and that Combs offered to pay him $1 million for the death of Tupac Shakur and Suge Knight. He says that he'd known him for years, as I said, and he met him through a drug dealing associate in New York named Eric Von Zip Martin. Davis said Combs first asked him and the Crips to work security for Bad Boy artists in the mid-1990s. He said Puff would give them tickets, they'd go meet up with them, they'd hang outside. He said all those shows at the West Coast were just full of Crips for protection for Bad Boy while they were on the West Coast. And he said a year into the security guard, Combs came to him with a much more daunting request. He said to him, "I've got a couple of problems I need to be handled, a big CEO and Pac." And Davis instantly knew that he was talking about Tupac and Suge Knight. He said, "It isn't a problem. We can make it happen." And he said there wasn't a contract or a handshake. It was just kind of like an understanding that it would happen. An LAPD detective, Grace Carding, he wrote about it in his book called Murder Rap. He even elicited a confession from Keith Davis in 2009 as part of this big investigation into the Shakur and Wallace murders. Biggie Smalls' mother, Valletta Wallace, would go on to sue the LAPD for $500 million based on the theory that the police covered up the death of her son. Her case was consequently reopened in 2006 and handed over to LAPD detective Greg Carding. Carding does believe that the murders of Biggie and Tupac were related. Based on 3 years of his work on the case, he believes that Sean Puff Daddy Combs put this $1 million hit on Tupac and Suge Knight. which linked him and Biggie to this crazy publicized rap beef. He says that Tupac was killed by Crip gang members, and the one who pulled the trigger was a man called Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, who was Keith Davis's nephew. He says that the original hit was supposed to be carried out by Keith D, but the plans were changed last minute after they unexpectedly pulled up to the wrong side of Tupac's vehicle. So Keith's nephew instead carried out the hit, killing Tupac and injuring Suge Knight. He said then Biggie Smalls' wife, Faith Evans, knew about Diddy's plot to kill Tupac. Apparently, after he was killed, Keith D contacted Diddy and Faith Evans, letting them know that they were responsible for the death. It's understood that Biggie had no idea that this plot to kill Tupac and Suge Knight was even happening, but Bloods gang member Wardell Poochie Foose murdered Biggie after being paid just $13,000 by Suge Knight in retaliation. There's lots of people who feel that Puff was kind of responsible in a way for Biggie's death. First off, Biggie was only in LA because he was there to promote his album, and he was there to promote his album because he just felt that he wasn't making enough money. He was actually pretty broke at the time of this second album coming out, and he was very frustrated with this because he felt that he should be making more money. He was actually meant to be in London at the time, but instead he went with Puff Daddy to LA. Now, Diddy's former bodyguard, Gene Deal, we're going to be hearing a lot from him today. He did an interview full of allegations against Diddy, and he's been doing them for a while. He has all the tea, to be honest. And it includes one that says the bullet Biggie took that killed him was actually meant for Puff Daddy, which would make sense because Biggie wasn't even supposed to be in LA that night. Many people also look at the fact that Puff was meant to be in the car with Biggie, or in that car, but last minute decided to ride in a different car. Did he know there was a hit out on him, and did he just allow his friend to take the bullet? Now, why would he do this? This is where we get even more conspiratorial. Apparently, before the shooting happened, Diddy bought the publishing rights to Biggie's music, as he did with a lot of his artists, for a fraction of what they're worth now. And Biggie's album, he probably knew it was going to be big anyway, but since he died, the album was absolutely colossal, and it made huge money in royalties for Puff Daddy. And people wonder, did he allow Biggie to die in order to capitalize off his success? Now we're getting into some darker shit, okay? So I don't know if you guys are aware of what went on between Diddy, Usher, and Justin Bieber, like really weird stuff that just doesn't make sense. And it's giving a bit of Pizzagate, but also like this, it's also giving legitimacy because people who are involved in it have legitimized it to an extent. So when Usher was up and coming in the industry, a huge media mogul, music exec called L.A. Reid, I'm sure you've heard of him, he actually has a lot of accusations about him recently, I think, sent Usher, 14 years old, to live with Puff Daddy. And Puff Daddy was in the height of his fame at this stage, okay? This is in the 90s. And he referred to this being called Puffy Flavor Camp. Now let's listen to Usher in his own words on the Howard Stern show, reflecting on these years in Puff Daddy's house.
I moved to New York City and I lived with Sean Puffy Combs for a year.
That's the crazy thing. Now, that was L.A. Reid's idea, right? We're sending you over to something called Puffy Flavor Camp.
There you go.
To learn
Flavor
some
Camp.
Yeah,
Flavor
that's
camp.
What it was called. And you're going to go to Puff Daddy's.
He's
gonna
in the 90s. Do you understand what that's like?
Puffy's place was like just filled with chicks and orgying like nonstop, right?
No, not really. But it was curious. I got a chance to see some things.
Yeah, but you were 13. What were you seeing?
I went there to see the lifestyle.
Right.
And I saw it. And it was. But I don't know if I could indulge and understand what I was even looking at. It was pretty wild.
So nobody tried to, you know, some woman didn't come along.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
I didn't say that. What I did say is that there were very curious things taking place.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't necessarily understand it.
Uh-huh.
Biggie Smalls was there.
Lil' Kim, Craig Mack.
All these people are hanging around.
Yeah, man. Faith Evans. Jodeci, Mary
okay?
J. Blige. They didn't know nothing about this shit.
Oh.
I was having a good time. You know what I mean?
Does he have you doing any chores? Are you doing dishes at all? I mean, to keep you humble somewhat? Or are you just like, can you stay up till 4 a.m. with them and party?
I mean, I could. I actually stayed up longer than them.
Do you have money? What's going on?
I mean, I had like per diem. Yeah. I had like, you know,
what
like
a
living.
Life.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
14 years old. You're a dad now. Would you ever send your kid to Puffy Camp?
Hell no.
See?
So pretty telling stuff there. Now, apparently Diddy would let Usher free reign around his house during these extravagant after parties that he was rumored to have. And these rumors of after parties are a bit of an open secret in the music industry. Like, we're not going to get a chance, honestly, to go through all of the small little kind of backhanded comments made by other rappers and people within the music industry over the years. But like everyone from like Jamie Foxx, 50 Cent, Drake, all of these huge artists have always said that Diddy has these crazy after parties where like shit happens there that you don't want to see. And I believe it was Fabulous, is he a rapper or a musician? He did an interview, I think it was him anyway, with Mace, I think. And he was talking about going to one of these after parties and saying that like, also, sorry, completely crazy sidebar. Diddy also had like a kind of private island vibe. Like it's not an island, but I think it's like within a gated community and he has a gated house within it, like a fortress kind of thing. I think it's called like Star Island or something. And he said he was invited to a party here. And he said, you know, at first you go into the house and there's just like loads of naked girls, really gorgeous girls, all this kind of stuff on the outset. But he said then when you go into all these rooms, like you start to go into the house and the further central you go to the house, you go into these rooms where it's just like all men. And now look, again, I don't know if I mentioned it earlier, but there is an underlying level of homophobia within the hip hop community, and the way that a lot of these rappers present these stories can have underlying homophobic tendencies, like, you know, like, oh shit, like all these gay guys doing gay, like, obviously, like, who gives a fuck if someone's doing gay shit? But it's when you kind of like look at the stuff with Usher, it's like, okay, but they also had young boys around here and they were letting them see stuff, and the stuff that Usher said was like, oh, you know, I don't think I understood what I was seeing. You know, it wasn't just naked women. Like, there was stuff there that was happening that I didn't really understand. So, you know, when you add it all together, it's pretty fucking weird. So it later came out when Diddy did this video with Justin Bieber for his YouTube channel that he had legal guardianship over Usher when he lived with him, which is fucking insane because Usher's mother was alive and well. There's also loads of weird comments made by Diddy about this time, about his time with Usher. And one moment which went viral pretty recently was when he was speaking to Kevin Hart and he basically let it slip that he knew Usher way before he was 14. Listen to this.
My brother right here from day one, we used to wake up and, I mean, damn, pause, but like, that's how, I mean, back in the days when he was like 10, I was a little bit older, his older brother, we used to fight over the Frosted Flakes, you know what I'm saying, before pause was invented, you know what I'm saying, but it's my brother for real, we used to actually wrestle off of the Frosted Flakes because he used to always get up early, now he's one of the richest stars in the world.
So if you didn't hear it there, he basically said that he knew Usher when he was 10. Now, Usher at the time when he was 10 was in the music industry. He was in a band called New Beginnings. And this was years before he decided he wanted to go solo. So funny to like want to go solo when you're 10. But this is really bizarre because people now think, did he get introduced by LA Reid to Diddy much earlier than was first reported? Usher as an adult was Justin Bieber's mentor. And there's another weird clip that's resurfaced of LA Reid describing how Usher brought Bieber to the studio and described him as a gift. Usher then immediately introduced Diddy to Justin Bieber. And that's when they shot that 48 Hours Together video. And this all kind of adds up to the rumors that Diddy is central or a pawn, who knows, to a huge human trafficking and sex trafficking kind of organization within the music industry. And again, I understand this can sound kind of QAnon-y and Pizzagate-y, but like, to be honest, industries like modeling and industries like music are rife for people to be taken advantage of. And especially when you look at the music industry and modeling, to be honest, because like, look, Epstein got most of his, not most, but he got a lot of his victims through a modeling agency, through Victoria's Secret, through all of his connections with elite models. Like, it's really crazy stuff. There are legitimate links there, and there's legitimate links there in music as well and in Hollywood. So this brings us on to the Danity Kane scandal. So a bit of background. This is where shit gets weird. We're going to talk about this guy, Clive Davis, for a second. Clive Davis is a music mogul. He's an entrepreneur. He owned Arista Records, and he is who helped Diddy set up Bad Boy Records in the beginning. He also mentored Diddy's mentor. Andre Howell. Now, Clive is also an openly bisexual man. He only came out in like 2013. I'm not sure if he's still alive. But he basically said that like he had, you know, a marriage with a woman and then he broke up and he dated men and women, blah, 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 blah. Obviously no issue there. And again, the way it's presented sometimes in these kind of hip hop gossip channels can be kind of having homophobic underlyings, but just to point it out there, if it sounds like I'm presenting things in that way, it's just because I'm quoting directly from the source. Obviously, someone being bisexual or gay doesn't mean that they're like a deviant, right? So singer Jaguar Wright has recently come out with a plethora of allegations about Diddy and sex trafficking and his involvement with Clive Davis. She claims that Diddy in his early career got sexually involved with Clive Davis, which gave him the power to effectively take over Uptown Records from Andre Howell. Now, Andre Howell, she alleges, used to be sexually involved with Clive Davis. But when Diddy came in, basically Diddy took the role. He was like, I'll be your new, as she called him, toy boy. And that's when he ended up getting to go on to pursue his own label with Davis's backing. She claims that this was a grooming tactic that Diddy then learned from, which is kind of how grooming works, right? Like, even if you look at R. Kelly, again, not an excuse, but if you look at R. Kelly, his background, he was sexually abused as a child as well, I believe. And most people who end up abusing become abusers, but it's not vice versa. People who are abused aren't likely to become an abuser, if you know what I mean. But that is, it's known as a circle of abuse, right? So it could be possible that Diddy was groomed, he became a groomer, whatever else. And then you also have, I think, that level of psychopathy underlying within you too. Anyway, she then goes on to say that Diddy has now become deeply embedded in a trafficking scandal and trafficking ring that he uses his label to do so because it gives him unfiltered access to vulnerable young people who want nothing more than to be famous. She claims that Clive Davis helped him cover up the scandal at the basketball event and many other scandals throughout his career, that he has connections with like police and law enforcement that made sure that Diddy never really got touched, which we saw when we ran through those scandals. It's something that is really creepy about Clive, and it's a bit of a tinfoil hat caveat, if you will, is that some people think he has links to Whitney Houston's death. So he was, I think, her manager, or like, I guess if she was signed with one of his record labels, he was the executive producer for that new Whitney movie as well. But as we know, Whitney Houston died in a bathtub and she was actually in the Beverly Hilton Hotel, and it was in 2012. Now, what people don't talk about is that she was there, I believe, because Clive Davis, who was also in the hotel that night, was prepping for his pre-Grammy party that was happening in the hotel the next day. Now, the next day, when Clive Davis was told that Whitney Houston had passed away in a bathtub in the room below his, he decided to go on and have the party regardless. Now, people are obviously suspicious over this already because they're like, would you really, like, this is someone you've worked with throughout her entire career. She's made you millions of dollars and you're going to go ahead and have the party anyway. But there's also evidence that Houston was beaten before her death. And many people think that if Clive Davis didn't do it, did he have her killed? Was he, you know, was he frustrated with her drug use? There's a lot of articles of him talking about Houston and her drug use and how she was like trying to get clean and all this kind of stuff. But back to Diddy. He created this TV show in the 2000s called Making the Band. Now, the show was famous because Diddy would use these kind of crazy tasks and hazing techniques to get the people involved. For one example, he got members of Da Band, which that was the name of the band in Making of the Band. He got them to walk all the way to some deli to get him a piece of cheesecake. And in Making the Band 3, he created this multicultural girl group called Danity Kane. Now in 2018, members of Danity Kane, Aubrey O'Day, Shannon Bex and Dawn Richard interviewed with the Huffington Post, where they shared reflections on their time working with Puff Daddy on the show. Dawn said it gave him an excuse. It was to let you know, this is my show, this is my shit, and I want to prove to you that this is my shit. I'm going to show you how much power I have by saying I'm going to control your lives. And it's so much bigger than that. Even though you're right, it was extremely sexist. Aubrey O'Day and Diddy butt heads often, the most often on the show. He would haze her the most on her appearance. He would say that she was bratty and that she was acting like a diva. She was fired from the show by Diddy due to her, quote, rebellious behavior. And in an interview that she did with the Huffington Post, she said that Diddy didn't like being challenged, especially by a woman. She said Puff plays one of the dirtiest games around. And that's what we were exposed to at just 17 years old. She also went on Call Her Daddy in 2022 and said that she was fired by Danity Kane because she wasn't willing to do what was expected of her, not talent-wise, but in other areas. She said Sean Combs was the hardest person that you can work for, and it was torture. Not just the work part of it, but the other stuff, the mind games. Diddy would say brutal things to Aubrey on TV. He insulted her looks. He said that she looked tacky and trashy, that if she wanted to change anything about her appearance, she needed to get exclusive and outright permission to do so, all the way down to changing her hair. Remember Diddy's bodyguard, Gene? Well, let's take a listen to what he said recently about Diddy's plans for Danity Kane, and think of it in context of all of the trafficking allegations that we now are aware of.
Indies, non-disclosure. That means that if you work for them and you're around them, you can't disclose any of the information about them. But there's some artists that didn't say anything, that didn't sign it, and they're able to talk about anything they want to. And I think that's those girls that was, I think, Danity Kane. I think a couple of them didn't sign it. And boy, oh boy, they probably going to go after him too. Because I heard him, and I'm giving you this, Aubrey. He stood up there and he said, in front of a lot of people, we were in the studio, and I said something to him and walked out the studio. He said, yo, I'm going to drug their ass off and pick them up and pip them out to my, pip them out to my nick. He said, I'm going to drug them out. I'm going to get them all on drugs, and I'm going to pimp their ass out to my... And I was like, there's somebody kids, and walked out. And it's somebody that heard me. I mean, well, it's not only somebody that heard me. It's somebody that I know who was in the studio at the time that happened, and I still talk to him today.
He said, I'm going to put them on drugs and pimp them out to his associates. Now, if that is not some crazy confirmation that he is openly talking about trafficking people, that's insane. So now let's move on to all of the accusations of abuse linked to his romantic relationships over the years. So obviously we're building up to this month's lawsuit, right? I'm talking about it. And I think it's important to build this case and to show how believable Cassie's allegations are with all of this background information, because anything in a vacuum can seem really crazy, but when you look at the history of this, it's very believable. And one thing I will note as well, there's obviously been so many people in pop culture, celebrity world, music, movies, blah 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 blah, that have been accused of some pretty heinous behavior. Even Danny Masterson had his supporters, and all of them will have supporters. You know, there's always going to be people who don't believe it, and that's just, it's kind of just part of the way it goes. But one thing about Diddy, like, say, for example, R. Kelly, okay? He has people being like, no, R. Kelly's great, blah, 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 blah. Diddy does not have a single fucking believer. I swear to God, everything I'm reading, like, all the other rappers, everyone in the industry, everyone's kind of like, yeah, kind of believe it. Like, I believe it was Angie Martinez, that journalist, or someone else, I can't remember, maybe I'm getting mixed up, but there was someone who was asked on CNN, you know, they were kind of like, so, you know, you've interviewed him multiple times, you're being a music journalist for years, do you think there's anything to these accusations? And she was basically like, I've never seen any bad behavior, but again, I'm a journalist, but yeah, I'd be lying to say that there wasn't accusations about Diddy throughout his entire career. So let's like take a look at these other relationships, because as we know, like, again, someone doesn't just become an abuser overnight. It is usually something that happens throughout multiple relationships. Gina Wynn in 2009 told blogger Tasha Kay that Sean Combs, aka Puff Daddy, physically abused her throughout their 5-year relationship. Her relationship began with him in 2005 when she was just 19, and they split for good in 2018, and it occurred during a period when he and Cassie were on and off, and he and Gina were also on and off. She claimed that once he stomped her on the stomach, caused her to lose her breath, he punched her in the back of the head, and she told a blogger that he was mentally, emotionally, and physically abusive. He would also compare her to Cassie and tell her that she's the bad one, that she and that Cassie's the good one. And she said that everyone in Sean Combs' circle allowed the abuse to occur. She claimed that she also got pregnant with Diddy's child and he paid her 50 grand to get an abortion, but she said that she refused the payment because she loved him and wanted him to see that she loved him and that she wasn't just in it for the money. And she also says that she got pregnant for a second time and was forced to get a second abortion. J-Lo is someone that he's dated in the 90s, as we spoke about, and they obviously had that pretty crazy encounter with the gun and the car and the shooting and all that kind of stuff. They broke up, as we said, pretty soon after. Now, she's never said that he was abusive or anything like that, but in 2003, she told Vibe magazine that her relationship with Diddy marked the first time I was with someone who wasn't faithful. She said, I was in this relationship with Puff where I was totally crazy, crying and going nuts. It took my whole life in a tailspin. I never caught him cheating, but I always knew. Besides Cassie, his most long-standing partner and famous relationship was with Kim Porter. Now, before she met Sean Combs, Kim Porter had a son with record producer Al B, and she would meet P. Diddy and go on to have three children with him, and Diddy would actually end up adopting the child from the other relationship. In November 2018, when she was just 47 years old, Kim Porter passed away suddenly in her house. And according to the autopsy, the cause was pneumonia and the manner was certified as natural. The coroner determined that she had no known medical history other than recent flu-like symptoms, but rumors around her death have always been linked back to Diddy. There's rumors that the first autopsy of hers suggested that the cause of death was homicide and that there were toxins found in her blood, with many people believing that Diddy had got her poisoned. Her ex-husband even referred to her death as a murder on Instagram. And the rumor is that she was about to write a tell-all novel exposing Diddy and his secrets, possibly about his abuse towards her, his sexual deviancy, and maybe even his links to the Tupac murder. Here is Gene, the bodyguard, talking about Kim's relationship with Diddy and how similar it seems to be to Cassie's.
At Kim's house on 110th Street, he wanted to, you know, put his hands on her in the wrong way. And Kim took one of those corkscrews and ripped his wrists up and hit an artery. And when she did that, he had to rush over to St. Luke's Hospital. I met him over there to the hospital. It was me, him, and Kim in the hospital when he was bleeding like crazy. When she wasn't taking that, she wasn't going to take that ass whooping, and she got him off of him the best way she could.
Diddy would apparently have Kim followed at all times, and once after a fight during one of their many breakups, Diddy broke Kim's nose while aboard his yacht because he found out she was dating Def Jam music executive Shakir Stewart. Diddy then apparently flew in a plastic surgeon who fixed her face, but she went back to Shakir anyway. In November 1st, 2008, Shakir turned up shot dead in his house, which was ruled initially as a suicide. The rumors are that Kim told him what she knew about Diddy's links to Tupac and Biggie's death. Here is bodyguard Gene again.
He broke Kim. Let's say allegedly, but it was told by people in her camp that he broke Kim's nose on a yacht. So Cassie's story is Kim's story. Cassie's book is Kim's book. Bro, when y'all look at this thing and saying force, y'all think this that he probably threatened to beat her, threatened to do something like that. That ain't what force is. It could come from the mentality. Yo, he put her in a certain position, in a certain situation, in a certain time in her life. You understand what I'm saying? That she saw no way out other than doing what he told her to do.
So prior to her death, Kim Porter was posting constant Tupac posts on her Instagram, which people think was a hint that she was about to release some pretty crazy information. And there's TikTok leaks of the book, allegedly. Now, there's no point in me reading through them because they're just so unconfirmed that it would just be spreading false information. But I will say that they involved knowing of Diddy's gay relationships, Diddy allegedly giving Usher an STD, an explosive encounter between Diddy and Usher's mother when she found out what was happening in his house, and apparently information that Mary J. Blige got pregnant with Diddy and was forced to have an abortion. Again, some of the best tea you'll get on all of this kind of stuff is from Gene, the bodyguard. I'll link all of those interviews below because you can actually watch them fully and get all of the tea. Like, he talks about bringing Diddy to Turkish baths, to gay baths throughout the years. Again, zero wrong with it if he's bisexual or gay, but it's just the fact that he's possibly using this as a way to control and manipulate and groom people. But finally, let's get on to the Cassie lawsuit. So on November 16th, Cassie Ventura filed a federal lawsuit against Sean Combs in New York, alleging years of assault. Her lawsuit contains graphic allegations of him raping her, physically abusing her, intimidating her, forcing her to take drugs, and making her have sex with male escorts while he watched and recorded it. The allegations were so shocking and detailed that even the court filing had a trigger warning, which many people have said is very unusual. The lawsuit was brought under a New York statute that temporarily allowed people to claim they are victims of sexual abuse to file a lawsuit after the statute limitations expired. And the window extended by the statute expired only last week, so she was under time pressure. In a statement, Cassie Ventura said, "With the expiration of New York's Adult Survivors Act fast approaching, it became clear to me that this was an opportunity to speak up about the trauma I experienced and that I would be recovering from for the rest of my life." It should also be noted that Cassie allegedly signed an NDA after she split from Diddy, which expired just days before the suit was filed. In the suit, filed in the Federal District Court in Manhattan, Cassie, who had long been Sean Combs' romantic partner, said that it wasn't long after she met him in 2005 when she was 19, very similar to Gina, he began a pattern of control and abuse that included plying her with drugs, beating her, and forcing her to have sex with a succession of male prostitutes while he filmed the encounters. In 2018, near the end of the relationship, Sean Combs forced his way into her home and raped her. In a response, Sean Combs' lawyer said, "Mr. Combs vehemently denies these offensive and outrageous allegations. For the past 6 months, Sean Combs has been subjugated to Ms. Ventura's persistent demand of $30 million under the threat of writing a damaging book about their relationship, which was unequivocally rejected as blatant blackmail. Despite withdrawing her initial threat, Ms. Ventura has now resorted in filing a lawsuit riddled with baseless and outrageous lies, aiming to tarnish Mr. Combs' reputation and seeking a payday. The lawsuit describes Mr. Combs as a violent person who, beyond repeatedly assaulting Cassie, asked her to carry a gun in her purse, very like J-Lo, and the lawsuit suggests he was responsible for blowing up a car of a rival suitor. In one incident, he also is said to have dangled one of Cassie's friends out over a 17th floor hotel balcony. The court papers also assert that people who worked for Diddy helped him to control Cassie at times by threatening her with retribution, like suppressing her music if she didn't obey his orders, or by helping conceal his behavior. According to Cassie's lawsuit, she was swept into his jet-set lifestyle not long after meeting him and signing with Bad Boy, which released her debut album in 2006. In addition to controlling her career, he paid for her car, her apartment, her clothing, and even had access to her personal medical records. One story in the lawsuit is really crazy. It says that the results from an MRI scan that she had conducted for memory loss, caused mostly by drug use and the beatings she suffered from Sean Combs, went directly to Diddy himself. Diddy also provided Cassie with copious amounts of drugs, including ecstasy and ketamine, and urged her to take them at all times. And when she didn't, he often became violent, beating her multiple times a year. She said she never went to police because she feared it would give him another excuse to hurt her. One incident in Los Angeles in 2009 says Mr. Combs became enraged when he saw Miss Ventura talking to another talent agent. He pushed her into a car and kicked her repeatedly in the face, making her bleed. He then had his staff bring her to a hotel room to recuperate for a week. In another incident describing the papers, says that in 2012, Mr. Combs grew so angry about her dating the rapper Kid Cudi that he said he was going to blow up the rapper's car. And around that time, Kid Cudi's car exploded in his driveway. A few years into their relationship, Cassie claims that he began coercing her to engage in a fantasy of his called voyeurism, in which she was directed to have sex with a succession of male prostitutes while Mr. Combs watched, masturbated, took pictures, and shot video. Apparently, he called these freak-offs, which involved costumes like masquerade masks and lingerie. They continued for years, taking place at high-end hotels across the US, and the suit says that he instructed Cassie to search the website of escort services to procure male sex workers for both he and Cassie. Drugs were supplied at these events, which she took because she said they allowed her to disassociate during the horrific encounters. Here's what Gene Deal had to say about these freak-offs and if he was aware of them happening.
Was he doing this back then, these freak-off sessions, when you were security? Because I'm looking at this lawsuit, and that's what they will call it, freako sessions, when, you know, Cassie, she'll have sex with the male prostitute while he'll masturbate.
Bruh, I can't say, because I can't say that. When I used to see him swing, it was always with him, another dude, and two girls. You know what I'm saying? When he was swinging with other people, you know what I'm saying? He always had other girls in the room or another guy in the room, even with his girl Kim, and he was swinging with her. So that freak off things, but him videotaping and everything like that, no, I can't say that I was privy to that. But you knew what was going on, you know, just in the instance when people got it confused when I said when he was in the room with Sarah and her girlfriend and he had Ja Rule and him in the room. Yo, I didn't know they was doing anything freaky until Ja came out and said, yo, y'all didn't want to be in there because there's a lot of freaky things going on.
According to the lawsuit, Cassie would delete the videos from these incidents on her phone, but that Diddy told her he still had access to them. He would save them on his own phone. And once on a flight, he made her watch a video, even though she thought she had deleted it. The lawsuit says that as a result from the encounters in different cities, Miss Ventura technically is a victim of sex trafficking. Miss Ventura's lawsuit includes several accounts of her unsuccessful attempts to escape him. In one example, during one of these freak-offs in 2016, while drunk, Puff Daddy punched Cassie in the face, giving her a black eye. He then fell asleep and she tried to leave the room, but when he woke up, he followed her into the hallway where he threw a glass vase at her, sending glass shattering all throughout the corridor. And according to the court filing, the hotel security cameras captured the incident, but Diddy paid the hotel $50,000 for the footage. The court filing says that in 2018, after Diddy and Cassie met for dinner, he forced himself into her apartment and raped her while she repeatedly said no and tried to push him away. After that, the suit said she left him for good. She married a personal trainer called Alex Fine the following year and now has two children with him. According to the complaint, her association with Bad Boy ended in 2019. The lawsuit was settled in a record-breaking 24 hours, which made Diddy look very guilty because clearly what would have come out in discovery would have been even worse than what was filed in this lawsuit. People critiqued Cassie, as they do all victims of sexual assault, for suing Puff Daddy and for not going after things legally. But remember her statute of limitations that expired in New York City. I'm not sure about anywhere else, but I know that they're pretty strict in America. And she only had 1 week to file this lawsuit under the loophole given to victims in New York. Oftentimes, victims of these crimes, as we always say, will file a civil case in order to bring information public, especially when it involves things like trafficking and everything else. This happened with Epstein, this happened with Weinstein. Like, it happens all the time. It happened with Danny Masterson. And then what happens is then it goes legal because it's way more believed, unfortunately, for victims of sexual assault. Police are way more likely to believe a case put together by lawyers than just someone going in off the street and giving a police report. You've got a higher level of success, I guess, in it going criminal. And it happened, as we said, recently with Danny Masterson. And look what happened to him. He is behind bars. Now, another reason why she probably did this was to encourage other victims to come out, because I'm sure she knows there are other victims. And 5 days after they reached a settlement, a former university student sued P. Diddy for allegedly drugging, raping and recording her, and afterwards showing their footage to his friends. The suit, which was obtained exclusively by Rolling Stone, claims that after taking the woman to dinner in Harlem in 1991, he drove her to a recording studio and raped her while she allegedly was in a physical state where she could not independently stand or walk. Days later, a friend of hers came to her and told her that he had watched the tape along with other men. Sean Combs has, unsurprisingly, denied all allegations, calling them a money grab. And right before the Adult Survivors Act came to a deadline, a second anonymous accuser filed a similar lawsuit against Sean Combs alleging sexual assault. In this suit, the woman claims that P. Diddy and singer-songwriter Aaron Hall took turns raping her and her friend in 1990 and 1991. She also alleges that days later, P. Diddy again attacked her in her home where she was staying. She said, he was irate and began assaulting and choking me to the point where I passed out. Apparently, he was searching for her friend because he was worried that she was going to tell the girl he was with at the time what happened. Once again, he has denied all accusations, but now everyone's wondering what's going to happen next. Will there be more people? I'm going to presume yes. It depends on what state they're in. It depends on if they can file a lawsuit. All of these things are very time sensitive. It kind of makes you be thankful. In Ireland, we don't have a statute of limitations around sexual assault. That was brought in because of the Catholic abuse scandal, because people realized, oh, wait, it's time and time again, people, victims of sexual assault, it takes them years to accept what happened to them. Like, then having a statute of limitations does nothing for anyone involved. All it does is let people get away with things. And this is just another case of that. So let me know what you think of any of these crazy conspiracy theories. I mean, I don't even call them conspiracy theories, but crazy links, dark criminal links of Puff Daddy. To me, he has always been such a dark character. He has always given me the worst vibes possible. Like, genuinely, he just gives me that vibe of, like, I would never want to be left alone in a room with him. And now I can see that my intuition was correct. For me, the Usher stuff, the Danity Kane stuff, I would love to know if the Danity Kane girls are going to come out and say anything, because as far as I know, some of them haven't signed an NDA. They've come out in support of Cassie. So I would love to know if anything else happened, especially, I mean, hopefully nothing happened to them, but those accusations that he was, like, pretty much planning on trafficking them is so scary. Did you learn anything new today about Diddy? I didn't know about the Danity Kane stuff. I didn't know fully about the J-Lo stuff. All of that's so, so crazy. I'll be back on Monday for another episode of True Crime Stories.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.